House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 21st, 12:15. We're going to jump out of order today a little bit. The first item on the agenda today is a public hearing on House Bill 2682.
House Bill 2682 was first heard on March 12th. It permitted private bail companies to offer commercial surety relief. We now have amendments before the committee. The Dash 2 amendment simply would require the creation of an interim committee to study the issue. I believe there may also be Dash 1s in a drafting phase, though I'm not sure of that. Do you want to call up the proponents?
Yes.
Follow me.
Romaine and Gardner.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I represent the American Bail Coalition. I'm an attorney in Portland. And before you are the 2682-2 amendments, which simply take what we've been doing and put it into a more formal study committee. The Joint Interim Legislative Committee on the Judiciary to look at the concept of surety bail and bring back recommendations either to the next special session, which we anticipate in February, please hopefully not before February, and or the general session, but we're hoping the February special session. What we've been doing, as we told you after you had the initial hearing on this bill, is we've been getting together with various interest groups, literally ranging from the Defense Council, district attorneys, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, everybody we could think of, the sheriffs, and trying to find out what works and what doesn't work, where licensing should be, crucial little details in this system. The system that we're looking at is something that doesn't replace the existing system, but it's overlaid over the current system. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it, and frankly, we're not quite there yet. We hopefully will be there. One of our big problems is actually getting amendments out of legislative council where we can see where we are, but we've had a little bit of a problem with it. So by adopting 2682-2, you will keep the process alive. It simply does a continues the study and should have no fiscal impact. It's something you would do to move it along, and then if we do get the substantive stuff together, we would bring it back to the Senate committee and then again to you in the House, but again, that's an if. You are going to hear some defense counsel who have been very good players with us in talking this through, who really don't like the idea of surety bail. There's a lot of issues out there of, you know, what are the real numbers, and that's something we're coming up with. What are the real numbers out there? What is the failure to appear rate? Because if you look at what some defense counsel says, their failure to appear rate is very small. Because if you, in a criminal case, you may have five or six appearances, and if somebody appears the first five and doesn't appear at the sixth one, which is the crucial, the trial, then your failure to appear rate, if you look at all that, is very low. But the crucial failure to appear rate is, did they show when all the witnesses, the police, everybody else were there at trial? That's the crucial thing. Those are things we need to iron out. We urge you to adopt 2682-2 and pass it forward and move it on to the Senate and continue this discussion. Thank you. I think Jim Gardner would also like to say a quick word.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for a company called 2Gen Incorporated, which does business as Aladdin Bail Bonds. It's the largest retail provider of bail bond services in the United States, does business in all three adjoining states of Oregon, in California, Idaho, and Washington. I, too, would urge you to adopt the Dash 2 amendments and would simply say that we're highly confident that the answers to all of the questions that will be examined will show this to be a major net benefit to the state of Oregon. It will be a revenue generator. It will be a technique for reducing the FTA rate. It will improve public safety, and perhaps most important, it will enhance the integrity of the judicial department, because nothing is more of a problem than when everyone's all ready for trial and the defendant fails to show.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? ready. Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Barker, committee. My name is Jim Hennings. I am the retired former director of the Metropolitan Public Defender, a job I held for 37 years in Portland, Oregon. I today represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are opposed to the return of bail bondsmen and are opposed to the amendment because we think it's inappropriate to bias specifically towards bail bondsmen. There are major issues, but saying that we should go yes or no in an interim committee on bail bondsmen, I don't think really addresses those issues. I am passing out to you some material. One of the things, that, and I was on that study group, one of the things that I continued to ask was, give me your business plan. Tell me how this is going to work. And I want you to look at that first chart that are two pie charts. Basically, we're talking about 10% of the money of the total bail. That's the money that is at issue. Right now, 1.5% of the security deposit of that 10%, basically 15% of the security deposit is gone. The defendant never gets that back. That pays primarily for crime victims and for public safety training and for a whole laundry list of things. There's a priority list. The other interesting thing is the remaining 85% is available to be taken by the state for fines, fees, restitution, and most interestingly, for child support. And in fact, and I got this information just yesterday from Dave Factor, in 05-07, $42 million was taken in on security deposits, $21 million was distributed, so more than the 15%, that's 50%. And in fact, on child care alone, $2.6 million was distributed. If you look at the bottom one, that's surety bail. And what we were told at the study group, surety bail is out of business if they pay out more than 20% of that 10%. In other words, they can't pay for their operation. They cannot pay for the profit. They cannot go above 20% of the 10%, 2% of the total bail, and still be in business. Already, right now, the state is collecting 50% of that 10% and putting it to victims, putting it to training, putting it to child support. So we don't think a case can be made, at least a case was never made to me as to why this was a good business practice. If it's not a good business practice, it becomes even more dangerous because that leads to cutting corners. I was here when bail bondsmen were in place before, and quite frankly, I don't want to see a return of that particular approach in which the whole system of the court was bound by what the bail bondsman wanted. So we are opposed. We think there are important things that ought to be studied. And what I proposed at that study group, we ought to look at the issue of transporting people through the state that the bail bondsmen pick up in other states. Because right now, they could be charged with kidnapping. I'd rather see a formal process as to how do we regulate that? How do we know that they're transporting? How do we know who those people are? There's an issue of picking up absconders from other states. But again, I think we can come up with a process that would allow that to happen with appropriate notice to local authorities. That may be something that's worth studying. I've also given you some information about the CANS program, which is a program in Portland that uses the phone to call people and remind them to be there. And on all the appearances that take place, if the connection goes through, as of March, We're up over 90% of the people actually showing up. Very, very few people do not show up at trial. The major area where people don't show up is that first arraignment. And that has a much less impact, obviously, than someone not showing up for trial. I put it in the hands of the information simply because there are other ways, if the issue is failure to appear, that we can address the problem. But on the underlying issue, should we bring bail bondsmen back? Should we take money away, quite frankly, from victims, from training, from children? I don't think the answer can be yes, and therefore, I don't think you ought to create by mandate, by statute, an interim committee. If you feel it's an important issue, then I think the committee itself can decide what to put on for the interim studies. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing Oregon's 36 county sheriffs. Mr. Chairman and members, I want to thank you for your indulgence in allowing us to be part of the group and as well as the proponents of the bill. And if the bill passes, we'll continue to participate in this exercise. The sheriffs did express concerns, and they do have some concerns going forward. Part of it is simply jail space in some jurisdictions. And that doesn't mean they're for these people not being held accountable. They are. But it's a simple fact of coming back and then being released, and then their status changes. So we will be in attendance at these meetings, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Wisnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hennings, thank you for all your work. The brief time that I was able to attend the work group, I know you brought a lot of knowledge and background on this issue. I think the time I've been in this building, however, that 89.5% non-collectible is still, I think, I forgot the number or amount of money we're talking about, but you know, you don't think that because of that, that there's something here we need to look at and continue to try to improve in the state of Oregon?
That's of the total bail. And as I said, the bail bondsmen are not going to be able to come up with more than 2% because they're out of business. By their own statement at that study group, they're out of business if they pay out more than 20% of what they take in. So can we collect more? And in fact, we do. One of the best methods of collecting is that you can refer that to the Department of Revenue, and actually if somebody has a tax return, that return can be paid. But reality, it's not going to be much more than what it is now, which is now 50% of the 10. So roughly 5% is the return you're getting now. The bail bondsmen, at most, are only going to get up to 2% of the total bail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I still think that I would support the amendment to see if there's something we can do. Other states are having some success with this. And again, Mr. Henning's expertise and work on this, I understand, but I would support the.
Okay, thank you, pal. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry, excuse me. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I had a chance to talk to the proponents and appreciate the information they shared. Didn't have a chance to talk to you, and I wasn't around or have no meaningful memory of being around when we had bail bondsmen in Oregon. What were some of the challenges that we faced, or what are some of the challenges we fear we faced, you know, spoken shortly?
The challenges, at least in Portland, were that the bail bondsmen needed to get remitters on any money that was due. They needed to get out of repaying the money. And one of the tactics that they used that affected me particularly was they had an open bar for all the judges at one of the bars in Portland. That leads to some real questions about why are the judges remitting? In other words, the person didn't show up. There should be a forfeiture, but there's a process. And in the proposed language, there was a laundry list of hearings that would allow the bail bonds companies to get out of paying what would be due because someone didn't show up.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Chairman, a good bottle of scotch is $50, and that's all they could take.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2s in House Bill 2682.
Representative Wisnet moves to dash two, House Bill 2682. Is there any discussion?
Yeah.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We can't move the bill today, so that's, we'll close the, we'll carry it over to April 23rd. Okay, and then where's the family? Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 3402. Representative Wingard. Apologize for the delay on that.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. I'd like Matt Minahan.
Okay.
And Teresa probably would be on.
All right.
Just well, if we can fit them all in, but bring them all. If you don't mind, we'll bring up all
five. That's fine.
I'll shift out of the way.
Well, you bring a chair. You move a chair up there's fine, or a chair or two up. Start it.
Thank you, Mr.
We're going to, Representative, we're going to kind of try to run about a 3-minute.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I've instructed everyone on my panel to be very brief.
Thank you.
As emotional as it is, hopefully they will
Understand that.
Be we brief.
Okay, thanks.
For the record, I'm Representative Matt Wingard from House District 26. And the bill before you, House Bill 3402, seeks to address a deeply painful issue within our family court system that I think we all struggle with trying to find the balance in when it comes to the very difficult situation of divorces or even when there's been no marriage, just over child custody and visitation issues. The people you're going to hear from today, Mr. Chair, are just a small representation of the tens of thousands of Oregonians that are outside this building right now suffering because of the way that our family court system is designed. And to put it bluntly, I believe that our family court system incentivizes conflict. And because it's created to ultimately prefer one parent in the custodial position and the other to be in the non-custodial position, it encourages that dominance and for both parties to try to seek that dominance in the outcome. It does not encourage cooperation. And as a result, I believe our system creates a great deal of anguish and despair. My own introduction to our family court system occurred 15 years ago when I had a child at the age of 21 with a woman, and we were not married. And I simply wanted to have visitation with my son, something that I thought would be perfectly normal and acceptable. I found out that, I was going to have to go to court and spend a great deal of money to try to establish that. And then I also found out at the time that we have a system where one person will be awarded custody and the other will be the non-custodial parent. And it became very apparent very quickly when I hired my, I'm trying to think of how many attorneys I've had in the last 15 years. It's well over five or six. The very first one told me that I would be the non-custodial parent. And this, without ever being in court, was on the basis of our sex. I mean, I was the father and she was the mother, and that was the way that it was going to be. Now, I didn't actually want to pursue custody. I just wanted to be able to see my son. But I found that that involved going to court constantly, and that my son's mother's attorney encouraged her to take an adversarial position because she could benefit from that. And I've never understood that. From the very first day, I've never understood that. And as a result, I have experienced that anguish and despair over the last 15 years. And sometimes some very dark periods. So I'll turn it over, and we'll keep the ball rolling on.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan with Dad's America. House Bill 3402 that's before you today is actually a collaborative effort between Dad's America and the American Coalition of Fathers and Children. It's very similar to bills that have been introduced all across the country. House Bill 3402 is part of a national movement to maximize involvement in children's lives from both parents. You know, many of you know me from the paternity legislation that we passed through here that was also very comprehensive. Together, this group, myself and our opposition worked together, and we worked through that and those issues and came up with a very nice piece of legislation. I hope we can do the same on this bill. My only comment would be, many of you who are here remember my opposition in this room was filled with opposition, and their hallmark was the hallmark to their testimony was the best interest of the child, if you can remember, the best interest of the child. This bill does nothing but promote the best interest of the child. It says both parents will be maximized visitation, deals with relocation issues, false childhood abuse allegations, which are on the rise. Again, this is a best interest of the child bill. I can safely say that is our issue this session. I want to introduce you to Dr. William Fabricius. He'll actually be speaking last. We flew him in from Arizona. He's received a PhD from the University of Michigan in child psychology. He's worked as a professor of psychology at the University of Georgia. He currently works as professor of psychology at Arizona State. He has over 45 scholar publications. He's received a major grant from the National Institute of Health to study the effects on fathers and their children, and I'm going to defer my time and save my time for him because he's got some great data to present to you today and talk about.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa O'Halloran, and I represent the Children's Rights Council. I'm also here to be the voice for the voiceless, the children of divorce in Oregon. Also, for the record, I'm a mom that was a victim with her children of abuse of the legal system. These are my boys in 2002, Tom 8, Jack 6. These are my boys last year, 15 for Tom and Jack 13. Due to a very contentious divorce, and due to the legal system that allowed that, my children and I continue to have and live in conflict with their father, the custodial parent. As with many states, children of divorce in Oregon have no voice or rights. One psychologist made the following comparison. The only difference between a bitter custodial parent and a prison warden is that in the latter case, they aren't related. Our legal system has created an environment that pits one parent against the other, a winner and a loser, better known as the custodial parent and the non-custodial parent. Thank you. Children end up being the rope in the middle of a tug of war. The outcome is that the children lose. Angry and vindictive custodial parents who limit visitation use the children as a means to punish the non-custodial parent, thereby interfering with this vital relationship. This behavior is felt to be a form of abuse, in my opinion, and of many professional opinions. Additionally, in Oregon, there are attorneys who pride themselves and advertise on winning custody and control for their clients. These firms even go as far as using health and human research services as a routine in their strategy for gaining custody of their wealth for their wealthy clients. They tout their firms as never losing custody. According to Health and Human Resource Services, approximately 60% of cases they investigate are false accusations made during a custody dispute. This is abuse of a service that should be used to protect our children and their rights, not use them as a means to win cases. Instead, this agency is being used by attorneys as an avenue of, and part of a strategy, a playbook, to ultimately promote their firm. If a presumption of joint custody was in place, this practice would cease to exist because there would be no financial gain by either custodial parent in the form of child support or by the attorneys in the form of an endless annuity of legal fees for high conflict cases. In some cases, the assets of the parents are looked at by attorneys, both sides, prior to even deciding how they're going to represent those parents. With the current laws in place, there is no avenue for parents and children victimized by legal system abuse to address custodial parents who alienate and practice hostile, aggressive parenting. The effects on the children of protracted custody cases is not only devastating in the short term to those children, but also in the long term in the form of depression, anxiety, and anger over the perceived loss of a once loving parent. My children and I are victims of legal system abuse in Oregon. In January of 2002, my ex-husband, a practicing physician, falsely accused me of child abuse and other serious misrepresentations on the direction of his attorney, Jody Stahancic. He also filed for divorce that same day. All this in order to have a leg up on custody. Helping Human Services was called to investigate, and I was cleared within 24 hours of the complaint. HHS was called in my case for the first time in the history of Oregon and was allowed by the Attorney General to come and testify for me. However, prior to that testimony, 3 weeks prior, an emergency custody order had already been granted by the judge in my case. In violation of state statute ORS 107.097, my ex-husband was not even present during the hearing as required under 107.097. I was never present, nor was I aware it was going on. I was not allowed to see my children by my ex-husband and his attorney for 3 weeks, even though I was cleared of all abuse. I was forced to tell my children that I was contagious with some sickness so that they wouldn't wonder what was going on. My six-year-old kept asking, "Mommy, when are you coming home?" And I had to lie to him and say that I was contagious. Additionally, my children were taken to a child behaviorist, Dr. Charlene Sabin, who worked directly and was hired by Ms. Stahancic without my prior knowledge. A hearing finally took place, and a psychiatrist, Dr. Gregory Hamilton, also hired by the attorney, testified against me without having examined me. 10 months later, just prior to final court settlement, I was offered joint custody, which I was thrilled to hear about. However, the custody evaluator's recommendations were completely dismissed. Instead of a 45-55 split, I was given 6 nights per month overnights. I was continued to be alienated by my former spouse with my children. Finally, after 5 long years and countless motions to the court, and still nothing happening, my former husband was remarried, and only then did I get to have my visitation changed through mediation. And the children and I are now reunited and we're together more. In addition to being a victim, I am also here as the president of the Children's Rights Council of Oregon, of which I was involved with on the 24 nights of the month that I didn't have my children. CRC was formed in 1985 by concerned parents with decades of collective experience in custody and reform in early childhood education. We are devoted to the healthy development of children. CRC is fighting in Washington, D.C., and dozens of state capitals as we speak. Instead of a parent in the winner-take-all doctrine, We believe in shared parenting, which gives proper access and visitation to both parents. The best parent, committee members, is both parents. I respectfully request this legislative body to pass this bill for the children of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Barker, members of the legislative committee, my name is Nitin Rai. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm a recently divorced dad. I have two children, 6 and 8, two girls. My divorce took 2 years, and my now ex-wife filed for divorce and came to me and said, I have the upper hand now, and I'm going to define the framework of how much time you get with your children. And that was one evening, and every other weekend, 2 evenings. And this is to a father who, you know, despite a busy schedule, my wife and I worked together. We were both actively involved in raising our children. I was very, very active. And within a few weeks, I was a marginalized dad. And that started a series of court visits and mediation and parenting evaluation. It cost us over $200,000. And over these 2 years, the level of conflict has gotten worse. And it is so bad right now. The divorce is finalized. We have a parenting coordinator that we've hired and spent money on who's helping us, supposed to mediate. And the conflict is so bad, it's impacting my children. Both my kids are damaged. My older daughter will not speak to me when she's with mom. She's too afraid to talk to me. The six-year-old says, Daddy, why can't I call you after 8 o'clock? Why can't I call you at bedtime and say, good night, Daddy? You know, why won't mommy let me do that? I mean, it is just unbelievable. And I absolutely blame the family law system and the way it's structured and the empowerment that the custodial parent gets. And the whole system is geared towards somehow appeasing the custodial parent and increasing the conflict at the same time. I firmly believe that her attorney enticed her and told her that she could get everything she wants, and she has no incentive to settle things amicably. And my story is not any dissimilar to Teresa's. I think hers is worse. But at the same time, what's happening is children are getting damaged. And I'll let Dr. Bill speak about it. But kids are being damaged by this system. We need to change it. We need to change it now. We need to make joint custody and shared parenting as a basis of anything in the family law system. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. William Fabricius, and I'm here from Arizona State University. I guess I should say I've not been paid to come here. I consider this part of my job. The state of Arizona pays me as a professor to teach graduates and undergraduates to do research, to get federal grant money, and also to perform community kinds of service, and I take that to mean helping to disseminate knowledge from the empirical research literature to public bodies considering public policy that might be supported or not from the research. So that's why I'm here. I consider it my job. Colleagues and I have just finished a major review of the divorce literature of the past 30 years with a view towards what it can and can't tell us about public policy. This is going to be published in a major series on families and children's development. So I'm kind of excited about that. I could give you a lecture, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to really resist the tendencies I have to do that. So I'm going to make about four or five points briefly. And I would be happy to answer any questions. I know these issues are very difficult. People have lots of questions about changes in policy and especially how they're going to affect families and children's development. So I'd be happy to answer, to the extent I can, any questions anybody has or issues you'd like to hear more about. I guess the first point I want to make is a very, very new finding that the public is solidly behind 50-50 shared parenting. We have done public opinion research. We find much confirmation of this, that regardless of the gender, political persuasion, religious affiliation, whether people have been divorced or not, but American adults at this point in time have bought into the idea that the best custodial arrangement for children after divorce is equal time with both parents. We've known for quite a while that when they are young adults, young adults who have grown up with their parents' divorces express very strong and overwhelming desires to have had more time with dad. We know that fathers also express to about a degree of about three-quarters of fathers express desires to have had more time with their children. We also know that the public now believes, when looking at the divorce court, the public believes the courts have a bias towards maternal custody. So this is a kind of a disturbing situation where the consumers, the clients of the court system, do not perceive the family courts as fair. Whether that's true or not, that's what the public believes. So the public is bought into 50-50 at time is what's best for children, and they don't believe that parents get a fair hearing if they take their case to court. The last point I want to make about sort of public opinion is that the awards and the number of parents choosing shared parenting is absolutely on the rise. In Arizona, we have some very good records from the court system, and over the last 8 years, it's more than doubled. Now, the majority of divorce decrees in Arizona, as well as in other states, are specifying very significant amounts of time with both parents, up to and including 50-50 times. So this is what's happening out there. Now, what about the research on the effects of these things? We have very, very strong evidence from highly high-quality research studies that joint legal custody, and I'll separate here joint legal custody from shared parenting time, there's very, very strong evidence that policies that presume joint legal custody have very clear beneficial impacts on families and children. Things like children's outcomes in terms of mental and behavioral health, also in terms of things like increased father contact and involvement with children, and increased child support payments. This is, across most of the country now, joint legal custody has become the norm. In Maine, for example, there's not even a law that specifies a presumption for joint legal custody, but over 90% of families have joint legal custody. So it has become the norm in many parts of the country, and there's very clear research evidence that it does benefit children. In terms of shared parenting now, the issue always before courts and legislatures is how much parenting time should each parent receive, and the current state of the research shows very clear relationship with increasing amounts of time that children spend with both parents is associated with long-term benefits in terms of their relationships with both parents, and there's very, very clear evidence that the relationships children have with their parents during childhood and middle and adolescence is related very strongly to long-term mental, behavioral, and even physical health outcomes for children. There's a lot of research, we probably hear about this now in many contexts, that chronic stress-related health problems can be traced back to early relationships with parents and can translate into significant public health concerns and even into early mortality. The current state of the research is showing very strong relationships, both on the one hand between amount of parenting time distributions up to and including 50-50 arrangements, translating into stronger, closer emotional relationships in the long term between parents and children. And those close, strong emotional relationships translating into mental, behavioral, and physical health outcomes in the long term. So we have very strong evidence for this now. Finally, my last point will be about the role of parent conflict. This is an issue that has dogged and puzzled policymakers and even researchers for a long time. Is shared parenting workable when the parents are conflicted and in conflict and in contention? The best evidence now shows that it works even in high conflict family situations. We can see now with good research detectable benefits associated with shared parenting even among high conflict families. So it does not make sense, and this is the policy recommendation that we've come to after a year's study of this, does not make sense to presume that shared parenting doesn't work when the parents are in conflict. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions for Dr. Representative Olson?
Thanks, Dr. Precious. I read a study a couple of years back, and actually it kind of supports where you were going when you were talking about the issue of the shared parenting, how it has actually greatly translated into dealing with and improving the mental and physical health of. But the study was interesting because, and I can't remember who the clinical psychologist was that did the study. It was a 20-year study. But what he pointed out was that it wasn't the first initial years that a child, having gone through an extremely conflicted divorce situation, it was 10, 15, 20 years down the road where the real serious impact. I mean, is that what you're finding as well?
That's what we're finding. We're looking at young adults who are between 18 and 22 and finding clear indications of physical health problems, even in young adults who are otherwise healthy. They're college students. But we have measures nowadays from the health literature that can identify the precursors of increased use of health care facilities as they get older, loss of work time from physical health problems, and even early mortality. And we can trace that back to the amount of parenting time they had. So we're looking at very long-term outcomes that are supported both by the research that we see and by our best current understanding of theory about how these parent-child relationships set up processes of emotional security that then translate into stress-related health problems. So the picture is becoming very clear.
I find it interesting, just I guess more kind of a comment, that in the past we've always kind of thought, you know, you have the husband-wife relationship or the partners where, you know, children, you'll get over it now, you know, and you'll be okay. We're just trying to get through this conflict right now. But that the impact is greater later than yes. It is immediately then.
That's
right.
Representative Krieger, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe more or less a story confession type thing. But about 44 years ago, I went through this and had four children. And I had to make the decision whether the conflict that they were going through because of the problems we were having was such that maybe it would be better I didn't see my kids, which I didn't for 4 years. And then we finally did get back together. And what was interesting is what the kids, when they became mature in their 20s and up to their 30s, some of the things that they then started revealing that I didn't understand at the time, because I was also quite young at the time. But the one thing you just said there about the effects on those children later on, mm-hmm. and that was really evident with all four of my kids, one of which is going to be 49 the 23rd of this month, so it's been a while. And I don't think we understand this as well as we maybe should, and the effects that these kids, that it has. And this issue is very close to some of the things that we've been dealing with dependency and foster kids. They kind of almost mesh sometimes, so I'm interested in where this might go and to learn more about it.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. On the next group, I have 10 people signed up who are testifying either neutral or against it. I'd like to have, if whoever wants to do that, if you could quickly get together and have like 5 people come up and limit the testimony, because we are starting to run into a time problem. Maybe we have like musical.
Both of them, either one.
We have musical chairs or something here. Yeah, okay. And I appreciate the fact that you're willing to limit testimony here. It's important. Thank you. So I'd like to have like 5 people testify, and I'm going to ask you to please try to limit your testimony to about 3 minutes. And we'll have a timer. When the light flashes, you'll know that that's the time you need to sum it up. You go in any order you wish. And I apologize for shorting that up somewhat, but hopefully the 5 of you will be able to cover what was needed to be covered.
rest of us. Okay.
Please go ahead and just identify yourself for the record.
I drew the short straw. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Russ Lepetsky. I am an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I've been a family law attorney for 22 years. I'm here today on my own behalf and also on behalf of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and the Oregon Academy of Family Law Practitioners. We, between all of us, family law lawyers in Oregon, have handled and seen literally hundreds of thousands of families in conflict over the years. And we don't, any of us, for a moment doubt or question the sincerity or the depth of the emotion felt on people involved in these issues. There's nothing that strikes a nerve quite as rawly as a custody issue, and we're well aware of that. The groups that I speak for have no axe to grind. We represent non-custodial parents. We represent custodial parents. We represent children of divorce. We cover the spectrum. We are not affiliated with any ideology in that sense. Having said that, the groups in Oregon that have looked at this issue over the years, because this joint custody issue arises pretty regularly, it's a common sense issue. On its face, it looks like it makes perfect sense. Why not order or have a presumption of joint custody? So these bills do come up pretty frequently. But every group that has looked at this, and specifically a 1987 task force by the Oregon State Bar, the 1995-1997 Governor's Task Force on Family Law, having looked at this issue, comes to the same conclusion, and that is that joint custody, when voluntarily exercised by the parents, is good for children. And you will see in the literature and the research, study after study after study, that states that the research shows that joint custody is good for children. That standing alone is true if, and most of the research supports this, it is because the parents agree to joint custody and want joint custody, regardless of the title. The greater weight of the research likewise shows that parents that cannot get along and don't want to get along and have joint custody imposed by them, on them, by the legislatures or the courts, those families do not result in children that have positive outcomes. This has been the experience of us practitioners with all the cases we've handled. It is, in my opinion, the conclusion of the greater weight of the research. There's obviously different studies out there that have different conclusions, but in my review of the literature, the far greater weight of it supports what I just said. And it is the position that our groups, that we maintain, and it's why we oppose the legislation that would impose joint custody on the parties. I don't want to take time from the other speakers because there are many of us here. With regard to the Dash 1 amendments, I'll just mention those very quickly. Those would effectively make this all retroactive and would open the door for anyone who has a current custody order to come in and say, there's now been a change of circumstances, and so I get to revisit custody just because this legislation passed. So the Dash 1s are not insignificant. I could go on and on. I have written testimony that I've provided you. The first page of my written testimony deals with the policy issue, and others, I think, will speak to that more eloquently than I have or can. But the remainder of my written testimony points out many, many, many technical flaws to this bill and other issues involving everything from the Oregon Evidence Code to burdens of proof and relocation. This bill does far more than simply do with joint custody, so I urge the committee to review the written testimony with regard to the technical issues aside from the policy issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Lauren McNeil, and I come to you here today in my capacity as Legislative Committee for the Oregon Association of Family Court Services. We are a member committee of statewide domestic relations practitioners, attorneys, psychologists, mediators, custody evaluators, parent educators who provide these services throughout the state. We also urge you not to move this bill forward. In 3 minutes, I will simply say that our written testimony covers both our policy concerns, procedural concerns with this bill, and many areas of technical challenge. I want to just highlight today in these comments our concerns about the bill's consideration of the role of mediators. There are a number of places where it seems clear that the drafters do not understand fundamentally the role of mediation. For example, there are requirements to mediate the parental relocation issues and also post-initial litigation concerns related to major decision-making, disputes about those decision-making areas, and requires the parties to be, quote, bound by the decision of the mediator. This is very troublesome to us because this will put mediators in an untenable position ethically where we do not render decisions by our various codes of ethics, and yet we will not be able to do that for the parties, but they will be seeking that for us under this law. There are a number of other places where we're concerned about the requirement to mediate and what that will do to our existing caseloads, particularly when what has been removed from this bill is a requirement to mediate the initial custody determinations. This has been the law for quite some time in Oregon. It works very well. Only a very small percentage of cases that are filed ever make it to trial. It's about 5%. And we would submit that in those very, very small percentage of cases that actually make it to trial, that it is appropriate for the court to make its own independent determination about the custody order. In summary, we have a system. It works very well. Parents are in every jurisdiction, can avail themselves of parent education, free mediation, custody evaluation, and other services that assist families in making a determination that is best suited for them. I urge you to take a look at the remainder of the points in our written testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that summary.
Good afternoon, Chair Baker, members of the committee. My name is Linda Scher. I'm a private practice family mediator in Portland, and I've been on the family law task, the statewide family law task force advisory committee, since its inception, and I've been the chair of the parenting plan work group of that commission for the last 10 years. And part of our work has been to create parenting plan guides to assist parents to create the very best plan for themselves that's going to be the most uniquely suited to their children and to their needs, but first their children. And you'll see in the separate handout that I gave you that it's just a summary of the types of schedules that are given to parents as examples of different ways that they can create a wide variety. I want you to particularly look at the way that they evolve over the life of the child and the age of the child. There is different needs that children have at different ages, and there's different needs that children have at different relationships with their parents. And it's important to recognize that the best parenting plan, which is this, we're talking about the parenting time schedule here, is the one that's uniquely suited to the family. And that's been the efforts, the energies, the resources of the state of Oregon and a lot of professionals in crafting support for parents to do that. We certainly all agree that bad outcomes, such as those described, very bad experiences, are bad for parents, they're bad for children, they're traumatic, and they shouldn't happen. I don't think this bill is going to in any way solve that problem. I think that the continued effort to support parents, both parents, to recognize the importance of their children's needs in crafting a parenting plan that fits best is the ideal situation. And just briefly, I wanted to add that that is the movement in the state that one example is Multnomah County, the largest county, has just recently adopted. They just threw out their standard parenting time schedule that has a fixed schedule that's a default. They threw it out entirely in favor of a system that encourages parents to craft their own schedule. So it's really the opposite direction than what this bill is going to. And I think it's needless to say that there are situations where there are dangerous parents for all sorts of reasons, for domestic violence, for substance abuse, for mental incapacity, that would put the other parent in a pretty untenable situation with a presumption of 50-50 time, especially, which is the part that I'm focusing on, and put children in danger. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. committee members. I hope you can hear me. I'm terrible with microphones. My name is Janice Ash, and I'm the Director of Family Court Services in Multnomah County. And in our service, we provide domestic relations, mediation, and custody evaluation, in addition to parent education, to about 1,200 families countywide, which represents a pretty broad group of folks. And I would say that we have a pretty broad sense of the spectrum of parents out there and the kinds of issues that they're negotiating and navigating as they go through separation and divorce. I am also a member of the Oregon Association of Family Court Services and a member of AFCC, which is the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts. And I've done some committee work also with the state FLAC, and I'm a member of Multnomah County Local Family Law Advisory Committee. All of which to say, this is an issue that I spend a lot of time thinking and reading about. There are a couple of important points from the testimony earlier that I'd like to address. First of all, from a personal perspective and in my own work, I come from a family of very involved partners, some in joint relationships and some separated, who have maintained involvement, and that's firmly supported. I think there's a representation that the system is biased against fathers, and I would submit that the system is impacted by a long history of socially complex issues that impact how decisions are made, and it's not necessarily about bias against fathers. And in fact, in my own practice, as I look at my evaluation outcomes, I recommend for fathers nearly as much as I do for mothers. So I think that's an important piece to recognize about the professionals in this field who work with these families. Dr. Fabricius represented some research and some literature. There are some facts that are important to know about the research and literature. One is that a lot of the research that looked at specifically father involvement and the involvement of non-custodial parents excluded parents with chemical dependency issues, with domestic violence behaviors, with child abuse behaviors, with personality disorders, with mental health concerns, and with other high conflict kinds of behaviors. That is a large population that is not represented in the literature, and that is a very strong argument for giving careful consideration to any sort of presumption of joint legal custody or joint physical custody. Second of all, much of the literature that looked at shared parenting time looked at shared parenting time as any parenting time in excess of 35%. So the notion that some sort of 50-50 Solomon-like split of a child's time is really shared parenting time isn't even actually what the researchers were looking at when they looked at shared parenting time. They really were looking at shared arrangements and children having significant contact with each parent. And I think that's important to know. Third, the literature is not clear on the impact of a presumption of joint legal custody for reasons that my colleagues have mentioned, and that families that have had that decision forced on them have children who have not fared well. The literature is absolutely clear, and there are probably 30 years of literature to support that significant attachment to primary caregivers in the first 3 years of life is fundamental. And I would suggest it is more fundamental to long-term health, development, learning, and mental capacity than shared parenting time arrangements. So one of the things this bill doesn't allow for is a protection of those relationships of children in the early years of their development, and that's a significant concern. Finally, and I will sum up, I think it's really important to remember that legislation that impacts children really does need to come from a perspective of best interests of children. And parents, anyone who's a parent knows that you make sacrifices of fairness all the time when you give up time and sleep and money and all sorts of things for children. We need to look at legislation and consider legislation that supports what children need, not to address an issue of unfairness necessarily to a small percentage of the population that we are serving. So I would fully support a considered, collaborative, multidisciplinary look at this issue in the future. I think it's worth thought. I think it's meaningful that people support shared parenting time and worth thinking about, but certainly not to address with reactive legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. My name is Philip Cook. I represent the National Family Violence Legislative Resource Center. I'm going to be testifying actually Tuesday in California. To answer your question, Representative Olson and Representative Krieger, is Judith Wallerstein, who actually did the long-term studies on the effects of divorce in children and found out indeed it was long-lasting. So Wallerstein is the name, and she has several books out, and they'll be of interest to you. My position on this bill is neutral. Frankly, I just learned of it yesterday. Haven't read it. I have no real written comments for you. I did quickly look up and made a copy of the Wisconsin law, and it's always good to save your time and, you know, not reinvent the wheel, so I'll pass that on to you, and also the other states that have passed similar legislation, whether it's a joint presumption or joint legal presumption. My effort here today, however, is to give you a history lesson. About 11 years ago, I came up with the concept of the children of divorce class. This is actually not my idea. It came from Kansas. At that time, the only jurisdiction besides Atlanta in the United States that had such a concept. I decided to introduce it in Oregon. We did that through a series of demonstration classes in conjunction with Providence Health System, also with the Monroe County Health Department, OHSU nurse practitioners, and so on. We had good media coverage, demonstrated these classes have a positive impact on the reducing conflict between parents post-divorce. I then wrote up a bill for the legislature, didn't pass in the first session. That's not unusual, is it? Takes about three times for a new concept. But eventually, with the testimony for the House and Senate, on the Senate Judiciary Committee and so on, the critical mass was developed in this body so that the interim task force actually simply included the bill which I originally wrote up. Now, that bill was very simple in concept in general. The legislature, in its wisdom, decided not to be quite as comprehensive as I first intended, which included things like outcome measurements, and which was of great concern to me, but that was not included. Now, as you are aware, some 10 years later, the majority of counties have now adopted the such children divorce classes and made them mandatory for all divorcing parents with minor children. Now, unfortunately, we don't know what the outcome is, but I can tell you what it was in Kansas, and I'm assuming the same is here in Oregon as well, and that is 90% of parents resented being mandated to the classes. 90%, once they finished the classes, were glad they attended. And all of them, that 90%, represented that it reduced conflict. My history lesson is this. At the time of that introduction of that legislation, which this august body did indeed pass eventually, the opposition was represented by the executive director of the Oregon Family Law Section, Legal Aid, and all domestic violence advocates. That's what the opposition was at that time. Now, Kate Brown actually sort of went against her constituency after some good discussions with me and supported the bill, as, of course, did many distinguished jurists, such as Judge Campbell from Washington County. Now, the effects, so that's what the opposition was at the time. And I would suggest to you that we need to take a long-term look at what the results have been of innovative legislation, recognize that those who oppose the children divorce class may have some of the same reasons for opposing this particular bill. It does not mean, however, that this bill could not be effective. However, what I do urge you to do, and most strongly, is to measure the outcomes of the effect of such a bill if you do indeed pass it. Now, I won't go into details about how that might be accomplished. However, there are certainly low-cost ways in which to achieve that. And I also urge you to, where possible, and I have not done the research, but I'll sure try and find time to do so, to look at the outcomes of what states that do, the few that do have, joint physical presumption. And I also would dispute one thing, however, that 50 shared parenting does not mean 50-50. This legislation that I can see says nothing that mandates 50-50. In fact, 60-40 is the preferred arrangement among those who, you know, choose it. because it seems to work pretty well in practical circumstances. But I see nothing in the bill itself, in my quick perusal, that mandates 50-50 as the de rigueur thing. So I just sort of wanted to give you that little history lesson. I hope to be able to provide some further information in hopefully a neutral manner about the research, about some suggestions in the language of the bill, and so on, and certainly try and get that to you. But I would say, hopefully, you won't be opposed to a new concept and take some look at the research in a very careful and considerate and neutral manner, and recognize that there may be some opposition to this new concept simply because it is new and, from the same people that oppose the children divorce class, which has proven to be quite successful in reducing conflict, even though these same groups said it would increase conflict.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much. Really appreciate your input.
Thank you. Could I just clarify that the bill does say on page 4 on the top of it, to the greatest extent practicable, the court shall allocate an equal amount of parenting time to each parent. So it does say that equal.
Okay. Yeah. With your patience, one final clarification.
Sure.
Our group, meaning the Mediators of Oregon, and in particular Multnomah County, where Hugh McIsaac was director and one of the supporters of the legislation for mandatory parent education, was a voice supporting the mandatory parent education. So I just don't want to lump us into a category.
Yeah, I did not say the family mediators were opposed.
Thank you.
Is anyone else going to testify?
No, that's it. And I want to be able to say something.
Yeah. Representative Krieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've taken part in a couple pretty major work groups, both on meth and dependency issues. Have one going on now. Representative Stigler's on that with me. We're going to take a year and a half, 2 year look on an issue. It might be well that, in my opinion, that a work group be formed to see what's appropriate to bring, as you've heard, stakeholders together and do a long-term look. And obviously, as you all heard there at the end, we should be looking at states that are already experiencing it to find out what they would do different or if it's working well for them. But I think if we could do something like that, by the time we got back here 2 years from now, we might know a whole lot more about each other and what we really want to try to achieve. It doesn't mean that you agree or disagree, but you've got to have the conversation. And because we forced ourselves with that, with the meth group, we got it done. We spent 14 months, on the last dependency thing, 10 bills passed out all unanimously, and there were no D's or R's in those work groups. We were representatives because we had a goal to do something for kids that was better for families, and we achieved that, and we will achieve it again with the new work group.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further comments? Okay. I asked that group, and I know it was suddenly that only 5 come up, and there was 10 people signed up. I apologize to those who signed up that didn't get a chance to speak. We're not moving the bill today, but we do need to move forward with the agenda. So I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3402. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2290.
House Bill 2290. House Bill 2290 has 3 different amendments associated with it, and they all cover different issues. The -1 amendments, the -3 amendments, and the -4 amendments. The -1 amendments allow a peace officer to cite an individual for using artificial light from a vehicle while in possession of a bow and arrow, rifle, or other firearm. The -3 amendments clarify the definition of a firearm. And the -4 amendment eliminates the sunset in ORS 475.235, which provides that a certified copy of a forensic laboratory report is prima facie evidence of a test result unless the defendant provides notice of an objection, in which case the statement should produce the analyst at trial. So there are 3 separate issues. We have the paperwork back on all of the issues. There are no There's a minimal expenditure impact, no statement issue on each of the amendments. That's the ones, threes, and fours.
Tenant Elkins? Oh, and I'm sorry, Al Elkins and Lieutenant Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. We're going to talk briefly today in reference to the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2290. These amendments address the illegal night poachers. Oregon State Police came to us in January with a concept for this bill, and we were glad to bring it forward to the committee. OSP works illegal night poachers with assistance of aircraft. The aircraft consists of a pilot and sometimes a spotter in the air who see a violation, and then they notify the trooper on the ground, and that trooper issues a citation. Recently, a judge dismissed the case when the judge realized that the violation was observed by the pilot but signed by the ground trooper. And the judge based his decision on ORS 153.042, which is the first reference in the memo that was handed out to you in relation to this bill. This statute states that a violation citation may only be issued if the conduct takes place in the presence of an enforcement officer. What the Dash 1s do, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, on page 2, line 3 of the amendments, is that they allow a peace officer to issue a citation to a person for a violation when the violation is committed in the presence of the peace officer or when the peace officer has probable cause to believe that a violation has occurred. So what these amendments do is bring into this statute the concept of probable cause. The Oregon Hunters Association supports this these Dash 1 amendments and urges the committee to adopt them. We'd be glad to answer. The lieutenant and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Hey, Lieutenant, do you want to say anything?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Lane, last name spelled L-A-N-E. I'm employed by the Oregon State Police, currently assigned to the Fish and Wildlife. I'm the Wildlife Section Lieutenant. I'm basically here to answer any questions that you may have after you review the handout that we've provided you. But this is one part of the bill, the Dash 1s, that will help apprehend the illegal night hunter before he takes an animal. It's been well used for us.
And listening to the probable cause discussion, so this is similar, excuse me, to an officer on the radar radioing ahead to another car to stop a speeder, even though the stop car didn't actually see the event, but takes a probable cause based on the first officer's calling him. Would this be a similar kind of probable cause issue here?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it follows the traffic ORS that allows a violation observed by an officer to be radioed or communicated to another officer to make the stop and issue the citation. And this would be the same.
Mr. Chair, I'm just thinking here that Representative Krieger should just absolutely be ecstatic over this bill.
Mr. Chair, there were two of us here that used to work Fish and Wildlife
That's
Enforcement.
Right.
We understand it, but if the traffic officer don't, we'll explain it further.
We'll explain to it after the meeting. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How does this relate to my concealed permit?
Yeah.
Which is being marked?
That's the Dash.
And Randy Wampler, Jody Beretta, and Paul Smith.
Speaking to the others, two's gone, we got three.
Two's gone, we got one, three.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm not Jody Beretta.
Yeah.
And I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are in support of House Bill 2290 with all of the amendments you see before you, especially the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s. And I'm here for the purposes of introducing Paul Smith from DOJ, who will be able to talk to you a little bit more about exactly what they do.
Barker, members of the committee,
My name is Paul Smith. I'm the Assistant Attorney in Charge of Criminal Appeals for the Appellate Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm appearing today on the dash to discuss the dash 3 and the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2290. The dash 3 amendments change the definition of the term firearm in several statutes, or in 666210, 164055, 166660, 161610. Right now, those statutes in general define the firearm as a weapon by whatever name known which is designed to expel a projectile by the action of powder and which is readily capable of use as a weapon. On December 31st, 2008, the Oregon Supreme Court, in a case named State v. Briney, interpreted the last clause of that definition, readily capable of use as a weapon, to mean either operational or promptly able to be made so at the time an individual is alleged to be unlawfully carrying the concealed weapon. In that case, the defendant possessed a concealed 25 caliber semi-automatic pistol, commonly known as a Saturday Night Special. It was missing a firing pin, but it was otherwise operational at the time. This bill would eliminate all parts of the definition of firearm after the word powder, so it would eliminate the readily capable of use as a weapon. The dash 3 amendments, excuse me. They would have the effect of clarifying that it does not matter whether the firearm is operational at the time, and the focus would solely be on what the weapon was designed to do, whether it was designed to expel a projectile by means of powder. So it would have the effect of clarifying that definition. The dash 4 amendment would make permanent to the changes that the legislature made to ORS 475-235 in 2007. Those amendments were passed in response to another Oregon Supreme Court decision, State v. Birchfield. In State v. Birchfield, the Oregon Supreme Court concluded that it was a violation of Article 1, Section 11, the Confrontation Clause of the Oregon Constitution, to require a criminal defendant to have to subpoena the state crime lab technician to come and testify before the lab report could be admitted. Usually these lab reports are admitted simply to identify a controlled substance. The 2007 changes passed the House 51-3 and passed the Senate 26-4. And what they did was clarify that if a criminal defendant wished to cross-examine the lab technician, he or she would merely have to give 15 days notice to the state of his intent to do so rather than have to subpoena the lab technician. The state would then ensure that the lab technicians were present. This preserved the defendant's confrontation rights. They were able to cross-examine the lab technicians if they wanted to. Also important, this saved a lot of resources system-wide, criminal justice system-wide. Prior to this, the 2007 changes, lab techs from the crime lab, as a matter of course, would have to be prepared to testify in every criminal case in which a lab report was at issue. They would have to travel all over the state, show up, and be prepared to testify, only to find that quite often the defendant had no desire to cross-examine them. This amendment, the 2007 amendment, which the dash 4, or excuse me, the 2007 statutory changes, which the dash 4 amendments would make permanent, ensures that the lab technicians only need to be available when there's a genuine desire on the part of the defendant to cross-examine the lab technician. If the defendant does not give notice, the state would then be able to introduce the lab report without the testimony of the technician who authored the report. The amendments, the 2007 changes, have been in effect for almost 2 years now. I've followed this issue for 2 years, and I am unaware of any problems that they have created. Thank you very much for your time on these issues, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Just curious, the language that the dash 3 is striking, the language that caused the problem in the Briney case, What was the intent of having that language in the statute in the first place? Was it to distinguish a firearm from an antique?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I'm not sure what the original intent of that language was.
Okay, follow up. But how would this affect the crimes we're talking about here, like felon in possession, right?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, yes, that's felon in possession, unlawful possession of a firearm, first-degree theft, and unlawful paramilitary activity are the primary crimes that will be affected.
What's the current law about if a person who's a felon has an antique weapon that would not be operational? Is that a crime or not?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I believe current law is that there's an exception for antique firearms, but I'm not positive.
Council?
I have a quick question, and I'm not an expert in this, so if it's a silly one, I apologize. But wouldn't this also affect any kind of attempt crime, where you have a robbery, an attempt assault, anything where you have to show that you used a deadly weapon? If in fact a weapon means it has to have a fire pin, and the gun isn't found at the scene, then how would you be able to prove that component in, say, an attempted assault 2 case or something?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I don't think this would affect any of the other situations involving use of a deadly weapon or anything like that. This is really a limited change to just the definition of a firearm for just 4 statutes. Deadly weapon and dangerous weapon are defined for purposes of other statutes, and I don't believe this would have any effect on those.
And I'm just asking because, honestly, I didn't have time to read Briney, so this is, I'm actually asking to be educated. So the case, so in Briney, when they were going through the definition, they didn't talk then about what changing the definition of a firearm in these kind of closed, narrow group of cases might, what effect that might have on some of the other crimes?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I don't believe the court in Briney expanded its discussion beyond just what the definition of firearm for this particular statute, 166210, would be.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Randy Wampler. I'm the director of the Forensic Services Division for the Oregon State Police. I'm here to talk about the -4 amendments for House Bill 2290 and their effects to the crime lab. In April 2007, the Oregon Supreme Court issued the Birchfield decision, which resulted in requiring district attorneys to subpoena the drug chemistry analysts in all drug cases scheduled for trial, regardless of whether the crime lab report was at issue. This decision caused the number of subpoenas to increase dramatically for our drug chemistry analysts. And then in 2007, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2340, which simply requires the defendant to object to the use of the laboratory report as prima facie evidence not less than 15 days prior to the trial. So when one analyst has 6 or 7 subpoenas for one day, this gives us a mechanism to manage those upcoming trials and minimize those opportunities for cases being dismissed because the analyst was unable to make the trial due to prior subpoena commitments. In other words, we can get our drug analysts with, you know, many subpoenas piled up for one day. Once they get that first subpoena in one day, any subsequent subpoenas that come in for that same day, they have to get on the phone and tell the prosecutor that they may be unavailable for that next trial. This 15-day gives us a 15-day notice gives us a tool to manage those situations. In 2008, the lab division had over 6,800 controlled substance requests, and the resultant number of subpoenas is somewhere around 1,000. Without the 15-day objection to the admission of the report, the resultant number of subpoenas that the analyst receives becomes very difficult to manage. And without the law, the district attorney would subpoena the scientists and wait until the day of trial to see if we are actually needed. Since many of the locations are a distance from the lab locations, our scientists will be often en route to the trial or actually have arrived at the courthouse when they're called off for trial. These unnecessary trips, of course, create a fiscal impact for our laboratories. Ultimately, this measure keeps the analysts in the labs performing their primary duties, and while court testimony is part of their job, without this fix, more analysts will be called to trial only to have the case stipulate to the report at the last minute or potentially be dismissed because the analysts had other court appearances conflicting. And it is our goal to maximize the time the analysts are working in the laboratory and at the same time make sure that we're responsive to the court needs. So at this time I can take any questions you might have.
Any questions, committee? Thank you. We have one more witness.
Representative Shields had it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shields, I'm sorry.
Thank you. My questions relate to the Dash 3 amendments. What do you think the likely impact of the Dash 3s will be in the number of cases that are prosecuted, convicted, et cetera?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I don't know what the impact would be in terms of numbers of cases that would be prosecuted. It would simply clarify. I think the Dash 3 amendments would clarify the definition of what is a firearm, so there wouldn't be nearly as much confusion about whether something that was not operational otherwise qualified as a firearm.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I can attest to the number of weapons we see in the crime laboratory. I actually, after this decision, asked one of our firearms examiners off the cuff what he thought as far as the number of weapons that we see with broken firing pins, and he estimated, just anecdotally, he thought there was about 5% of the weapons that we receive have broken firing pins, and when you consider that we receive probably several hundred a year, 5% is a fairly significant number.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair. Representative
Stegler. I just want to be real clear. The Dash 4s essentially codify on a permanent basis rather than a sunset the existing situation with respect to these forensic lab reports, correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, that's correct.
So that's what's been in operation in the last couple of years?
Yes.
And again, on the Dash 3s, it's my understanding the definition would then come in, it would be in concert with existing other existing definitions under 166.210 for firearms.
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, I'm not sure I understand the question.
It indicates it has a meaning given that term in ORS 166.210. The Dash 3s.
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, that's correct.
So rather than have a standalone definition, it brings it under what the current definition is for firearm under 0.210?
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, this would change the definition under 166.210,
okay.
And then for the remaining statutes...
It would bring it into compliance.
It would bring it, gotcha. It would
okay.
Make it the same.
But I guess my point I'm trying to make is it's not you're not creating a new discrete definition.
Chair Barker, Representative Siegel, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so explain to me why this wouldn't come into play in the difference between robbery one and robbery two.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I believe the difference between robbery one and robbery two does not deal with whether something was a firearm, but instead whether there was a deadly or dangerous weapon involved, which has a discrete definition. This change to the firearm definition really does just affect these four statutes.
So, if I could, so the firing pin wouldn't be the determining factor on whether or not it was a deadly weapon for Rob 1.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I believe that's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Any questions? Thank you, panel. Bill Meyer, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA has no position on the Dash 1s. It does register in opposition to the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s. As to the Dash 3 amendment, we have concerns changing the definition of a firearm that impacts more statutes than really just what was involved in the Briney case. The Briney case, by the Mr. Smith's own testimony, is an unusual case where you had an inoperable fire pin. You don't see that a lot in most firearm prosecutions. By changing the definition here in this one statute, it does have ramifications throughout several crimes registered in the criminal code. And there's calibration in those statutes as to whether or not the firearm needs to be operable or not. So if you look on page 2 of the dash 3 amendments, you're dealing there in section 2 with ORS 161.610, and that deals specifically with use of a firearm in the commission of a felony. And heretofore, prior to this, it didn't require that the firearm be readily capable for use as a weapon. It already had in there that, as used in this section, firearm means a weapon that is designed to expel a projectile by the action of black powder or smokeless powder. And in line 23, the use or threatened use of a firearm, whether operable or inoperable by a defendant during the commission of a felony, may be pled and be an aggravated felony because of it. This statutory fix will affect several statutes which are intentionally calibrated to the issue of whether or not a firearm is an inherently dangerous implement at the time it's being used. And I think that the statutory fix here has ramifications far beyond the need that was even suggested in the Briney case. Where are my notes?
Representative Garrett?
May I just interject?
Yeah.
The testimony we have from Mr. Smith identifies four crimes that would be affected by this change: unlawful possession, felon possession, first-degree theft, and unlawful paramilitary activities. Are you in agreement that those are the four, or are you saying that it goes beyond those four?
As to crimes, I don't dispute that, but it does also amend and affect ORS 161.610. Which talks about an aggravator. It's an aggravated felony when you commit a felony with the use of a firearm. I'm sorry to be so slow here, just a moment. Enhanced penalty for use of a firearm during the commission of a felony. And that provision, as you know, set out here again on page 2, lines 23 and 24, already incorporated the use or threatened use of a firearm, whether operable or inoperable. So all I'm pointing out here is there is a tightly knit statutory code here that is already calibrated to consider whether or not a firearm is operable or immediately capable or not. And because it's a rare instance when you have a firearm crime with an inoperable weapon because of a pin, I question the need to make the statutory change when it has ramifications throughout the code.
Representative Garrett?
I'm not sure I totally understood that, but if you're saying that under 610, is that the statute?
Yeah.
If that statute applies whether a firearm is operable or inoperable,
mm-hmm.
what difference are we making with the dash 3 by taking out the readily, whatever that says,
right.
readily capable of use?
Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, members of the committee, as to that one, not a big change.
Okay.
My point being that by changing the definitional section here, we're impacting other crimes down the road other than just the Briney decision, and we question the need to do that. And it can impact whether conduct is more reprehensible, less reprehensible, depending upon whether or not the firearm is capable of being used or not.
Just a final follow-up. That's exactly what I'm trying to figure out, though. Are we talking about, are we opening the door? Are we opening a can of worms here, or is it limited to the four offenses identified in Mr. Smith's testimony?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I would agree with you on the face of the bill. It affects those four crimes.
Thank you.
Mr.
Representative Stiegler.
Follow-up to that. Representative Garrett, in looking and reading 161.610, if you look at the definition of firearm there, it's exactly what they're proposing to adopt as the definition of firearm in dash threes. It doesn't, it's in concert with, it's the same definition. And so, in other words, what they're doing is changing the definition under those list of enumerated statutes to be compatible with the actual definition or definition under the enhancement provisions of 610. So it's bringing them in concert with each other. It's not changing that definition at all.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I can expound further on really where I'm going with this. So, for instance, if you look on page 4, it amends the Theft 1 statute, line 23. So generally, when we commit a theft, it's the degree of the theft is calculated based on the value of the property, unless the property has certain characteristics that make its theft warranted of being a felony, more serious. And so, for instance, it's theft one if the subject of the theft is a firearm or is an explosive. I would submit to you that that would connote that both of those properties should be readily capable of being dangerous. And if you have an inoperable firearm, I question whether you need to make that a theft one. Similarly, over on page 5, with respect to unlawful paramilitary activity, it includes on page 23 there the definition that exhibits, displays, or demonstrates the use, application, or making of any firearm, explosive, or incendiary device, or any technique capable of causing injury or death to persons. I again question whether you would need to penalize that conduct if, in fact, the firearm were inoperable and not readily capable of being used. So I just say that this fix
affects other crimes that are calibrated to match inherently dangerous implements.
And a firearm that doesn't have an operable firing pin in our position doesn't qualify as that.
Thank you. Representative Stiegler.
Mr. Chair, I just want to be really clear here, because I'm sitting here reading the statute, 161.610, and what you're referring to is currently in that statute, and the only thing that's changed here is rather than spell out, it doesn't expand what the definition of firearm applies to. The definition of firearm under 161.610 is exactly what they're proposing to change the definition to under these other provisions, and all of those, the theft and all of those things are currently what are exactly what's listed under that statutory provision for enhancement under this definition that they're proposing to adopt for those four particular areas. So I just don't, they're not, there's nothing here that is expanding current law except to clarify the definition and make it basically the same definition as is currently in that statute.
I think your comment again was focused back to 161.610, and I did concede in answer to Representative Garrett's comments that I don't think the statutory fix makes that big of a difference. My point being, we already have the ability to enhance a felony for the brandishment of a weapon that's not operable. So we don't need this statutory fix to catch that conduct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think there's as much disagreement up here as it might seem from the discourse. This, I think it's been fairly well established this bill affects four crimes. And I think it's also been well established that, yes, these four crimes, that is slightly broader than the Briney case. That said, I do think Ms. Myers raises an interesting point with respect to two of those four crimes, i.e. theft one, and paramilitary activity. It does seem, it's kind of an interesting policy question. It's a very, very small one, I admit, but I don't think it's as vast as we might think. And then, anyway, I believe that the questions before us are actually fairly narrow.
Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Myers, is your concern what if the person with the gun didn't know that it was a bad firing pin? Is that, or if he knew it, is that any of your concern? Is that where you're going with this? If the guy thought it was a good weapon and it just didn't have a firing pin, is that in the commission of the crime? Is that your concern, or is it the fact that the guy grabs a gun? Now, if a guy grabs a gun knowing it's not operable, one thing. Or if he has a gun and doesn't know it, then that guy should be held to a higher level of crime too. Would you agree? Or
Representative Barker and Representative Whitsnett, I'm trying to think quickly here on possession of a concealed firearm, whether the defendant needs to know whether or not the weapon is readily capable as use of a weapon. I'd have to look that up. But that is not the gist of what I'm saying. The gist of my comments is that this statutory fix affects crimes that the legislature previously had carefully calibrated in consideration of whether or not the weapon is, operational or not, and inherently dangerous or not. And by this fix, it affects that calibration.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
But again, the guy didn't know it. He just lucked out so he can get a lesser crime, because that's one thing. But the guy thought it was the gun was operational. That's another issue. It's the person, not the gun.
Representative Barker and Representative Witness, and it also loops into counsel's question about the attempts. I mean, I think we can go on with this conversation. It does go on with respect to the attempts, too. Shall I address the dashboards?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Could be much more confused than I am now. Oh, don't bet on it.
Okay, the dashboard. OCDLA would like to see the sunset remain in place so that the 2007 fix expires. The way it used to be was statutes prior to 2007 read that if the state wanted to get in a certified copy of the analyst's report, and the report itself would be prima facie evidence of the findings in that report, and it was the defendant's obligation to actually affirmatively subpoena the analyst to the courtroom if the defendant wanted to contest the lab report. The Oregon Supreme Court held in State versus Birchfield that violated the defendant's rights of confrontation. You cannot shift to the burden of proof in a criminal case never falls on the defendant. It's always the state's burden of proof to prove its elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And so you can't shift the obligation to the defendant to get any of the state's witnesses into the courtroom. So then post-Birchfield in 2007, there was an amendment, a new bill. And what it said was, okay, well, the defendant doesn't need to subpoena the analyst into the courtroom, but what we're going to do is we're going to place the burden on the defendant to give notice 15 days prior to trial as to whether or not they want that analyst in. And if the defendant misses that 15-day window, too bad. The state We would suggest that is still A, bad law, B, unfair, C, potentially unconstitutional, but we won't go that far right yet. The point of it is this. The setting of the trial date can be a real bouncing ball. You can't, particularly in some of these counties, you are bopping down the docket, sometimes days, 2 days, 3 days, sometimes 3 weeks, 1 day. You can't know where that end date is. It's a logistically cumbersome thing. The question is, where should the onus be if you've missed the filing deadline? And the 2007 fix put the onus on the defendant. If you don't file your notice in time, too bad. We're going to get the paperwork in. We're not going to get the analyst in. We think the burden should be reversed. It should be the government's obligation to come to the defense and say, would you please waive this? And, let the burden be on them to come in within the time frame from trial and seek the waiver. That's more consistent with the defendant's confrontation rights. The default position should always be the defendant gets the right of confrontation, and it should be the state that seeks out the exception to that.
What's been the experience of the bill? I mean, has there been cases where somebody filed in 14 days and they've been told, no, you can't have it?
Representative Barker, I really wish I had a better answer for you. And my answer to you is I don't know. And I can get that information. I'll put that question out over the pond.
It would seem to me the whole idea behind that is the trouble of getting, which they testified, having the technicians or whatever, scientists, whatever you want to call them, appearing in court. And it would seem to me that the law passed in the last session was to take care of that, because you do have, I mean, I can recall having to try to find somebody and they're, well, they can't be there today because they're somewhere else and today's the day and right. Those kind of things. This would allow court scheduling, which I think would be to the advantage of the defendant in that by saying I'm going to need the technician there, they could put on notice and then they could start setting a calendar to be sure that that person would be available for cross-examination.
And Representative Barker, I'm not suggesting that the analyst should be present at all trials. I'm just saying the onus should be on the government to seek a waiver. That would be consistent with the confrontation right.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have a question, Representative Barker?
I do, Mr. But not to Ms. Meyer.
Okay.
Actually, I wouldn't perhaps mind speaking to DOJ regarding Dash 3s again. Or district attorney or whomever.
Thank you. Well, do you pick them?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any problem with the Dash 1s. I don't have any problem with the Dash 4s. With respect to the Dash 3s, actually, again, I don't really have a significant problem with the Dash 3s as a whole. That said, the more I think about it, the more the Theft 1 portion, which is in Section 3 on page 4, is of some concern to me, more so than the paramilitary. It's the Theft 1, i.e., it's there's somehow our statutes make it a greater offense if you're stealing a weapon or an explosive device. But what if it's not, if it can't be operated as either a weapon or explosive device, it kind of undermines the purpose of the enhanced sentencing.
The point I was trying to make was the current law is that that very definition that they're asking to change it to, what's on page
610, that's not what I'm referring to, Representative.
No? What, you're referring to 166.210? Then?
No, I'm referring to 164.05.
164.05.
055, sorry.
I'm lost. You're not on page 2 of the
I'm on page 4.
Amendment?
Page 4 and 5 of the Dash 3.
Pardon me. Line 23.
All right. Page 4, line 23.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I apologize. We're back on.
I was going to respond to Representative Barker.
Please.
I understand the point. I'm comfortable with the change because I think the purpose of the law is to say a person who is stealing certain types of objects needs to be treated more severely. I think that would apply whether the person correctly or incorrectly thinks he is stealing a gun. If you're out to steal a firearm and the firing pin happens to be missing, I'm not sure that should ameliorate the punishment. So I think,
Mr. Chair,
I'm satisfied.
May I respond?
You may.
So I think that's similar a point that Representative Wisnett made essentially earlier. And that is, I'm going to go back to literally my first day of law school. It was a traumatic day. And there was an example used by...
And that was the professor that made that statement.
Indeed. Let's pretend there's box of umbrellas, we'll say, one of which belongs to me, one of which belongs to Representative Garrett. Let's pretend I then go up and attempt to steal Representative Garrett's umbrella, but because they all look similar, I actually take my own umbrella. No crime has been committed. And the reverse as well. Let's pretend I actually mean to take my umbrella, but I accidentally take Representative Garrett's umbrella. Again, no crime has been committed. This, I think it is entirely relevant. Let's pretend you intend to steal a gun, but in fact it's not. In any way, shape, or form, I don't believe that's theft one because there's no actus reus.
I would be my suggestion that if it's an umbrella, it's not a gun, but if it's a gun, it's a gun.
There's a different way.
Here I move the Dash 3 amendments.
Wait a second. I'm not sure. Okay, we'll have some discussion then about that.
Okay, there's been a move to put the Dash 3 in discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you might expect, my concern is more around the fiscal aspects of the dash threes than around the merits or demerits of the policy. And so my question is for counsel, is the notion, do you think, I mean, it's hard to tell because fiscal wasn't here. I'm sure they knew exactly what the dash threes did when they created the fiscal statement. But my is the notion that there wouldn't be any additional incarceration happening because of this? From what their testimony is that if 5% of the weapons had some type of firing pin problem, it would seem to me that an additional, you know, 15 to 20 people might be incarcerated for some length of time because of this. And that very well may be a good policy, but it seems to me to be one that Ways and Means might want to take up.
I guess there's a couple things, Representative Shields. I cannot speak directly for LFO. I just want to make sure, because every time I do, I get an email, so I'm not. I guess what we're talking about is policy, and I do have to apologize because I've been a little bit too involved in policy and less in law at this point, and so I did make a mistake on your staff measure summaries, and I didn't have a chance to read Bryony, so I will apologize to everybody for that. With respect to this, my understanding is that there's been a recent court case that has changed the way they look at the definition of what a firearm is. So I don't believe, so what we're not what we're looking at now is essentially looking at cases as we have always looked at them. It's not our eyes that have changed, it's the court's eyes that have changed. So this change is being made so that everything will proceed into the future the way it has been. So as I analyze that, there won't be an increase because essentially, to some extent, even though you're making a change, you are actually maintaining the status quo in this particular area. So I do believe that that's what fiscal would have taken into account when they spoke to the courts and whomever else, probably the prosecutors and probably DOC and everybody else. The other thing is that even if there are, for whatever reason, a slight increase, this would be a theft one, and there need to be other things in play before a theft one becomes, as I know you know, a prison offense. So even if there was an increase, it would be a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of those that would actually be a prison sentence as a result of the sentence or a conviction of theft one.
Mr. Chair. So basically, if this happened to you yesterday, there wouldn't be much of a difference after this bill passed, because you would just be continuing the same policy, and in the past cases, people were being incarcerated on these or jailed, depending on the severity. I mean, we're basically continuing the policy. We're just adjusting to what the courts have
told us to do. The court doesn't have
to
leave in December, so it would have been about a month of difference. But yes, exactly.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Further questions? There's a motion.
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. I think we were. I don't think we were. I think I called for a hearing.
my colleague was here.
Yeah. Work session. We are in work session.
We close up in here.
We are in work session.
And if I may.
Yes.
If I may, committee, I'd just like to remind you there are three amendments before you that are all separate, so nothing supersedes.
Right. I was going to ask that clarification.
Describe those all three amendments.
One, three, and four.
So we'll
do one at a time.
Move the dash one.
President Garrett moves the dash one. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the dash ones? Hearing none, so ordered. Garrett moves the dash threes. Is there objection?
Okay.
Call the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't oppose the dash threes. My objection is fairly abstract, but nonetheless, I think relevant regarding the theft component. It's not big enough for me to prevent to vote against this bill. That said, I plan to discuss it with some of my Senate colleagues.
Okay, thank you. Okay, call the roll on the dash threes, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
The streets are in.
Mr. Chair,
I'll
move the dash fours.
Representative Cameron moves the dash fours. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Now we move the whole bill.
Mm-hmm.
We move the whole bill.
Chair, I move House Bill 290 as amended by dash 1, dash 3, and dash 4 of the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2290 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Any further discussion before we vote? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair. Representative Barton showed great enthusiasm.
All right, Representative Garrett will carry.
Yes. Might have some questions, Representative.
Okay. Off we go.
Treat your buddies like
that. All right. Have we done that or not?
Yeah.
We have a hearing or just go? Yeah. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3051.
House Bill 3051, again, the dash one amendment on this bill deletes the original bill, and it provides that the dash one addresses the gap in the implied consent law by adding evidentiary provisions to the statute that would make the admissibility of urine testing consistent with the statute's addressing blood and breath testing. You have the dash ones. I do not yet have the paperwork on it.
All against them.
All against
them.
3051. Okay, please. Okay, come on. Mrs. Howard, Mrs. Bryson, Ryerson, and Mrs. Womper, or Randy Womper, please. I'm sorry. And, okay. Please begin one and identify yourself, please, for the record.
Vice Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We are in strong support of House Bill 3051-1. This bill, among other things, will serve to clarify statute and save the state a little bit of money. Dina Ryerson is here to answer any questions that you may have and explain the bill further.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Vice Chair Wisnant and members of the committee. My name is Dina Ryerson. I work at the Department of Justice, and I'm here to provide the technical information on this bill. Under implied consent law, a police officer is able to get either a breath test, a blood test, or a urine test, depending on what their belief is. Relevant to this is a urine test if they believe someone's under the influence of a controlled substance. Recently we had a case come down a couple weeks ago where the Court of Appeals basically said there is not the similar language in the urine section as there is in the breath and blood section that makes the urine test results admissible into evidence if done in a licensed or accredited lab. Currently, the language does say, a urine test has to be done in a licensed or accredited lab, but neglected to leave the language saying and is admissible, such as in the blood section and in the breath section. So what this bill is trying to do is to make urine analysis reports admissible into evidence just as they are in the blood section and in the breath section to put everything in line if done in an accredited lab. The risk in not passing it is that there will be potentially different rulings all over the state on whether judges believe that our crime lab does the proper protocol in testing urine. And so that's the risk, and I believe we have the crime lab to talk about the other risks, and I'm open to any questions that you might
Thank
have.
Thank you. Mr. Wampler.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Wisnant, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Howard. I am a forensic scientist employed by the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division. I'm a toxicologist at the Springfield Laboratory. Although the State Police Crime Lab has six crime labs statewide, only two of those labs, the Portland Lab and the Springfield Lab, perform urine toxicology for these DUI cases that Ms. Ryerson was referring to. It is anticipated after this recent case that came out, that the DAs will be subpoenaing our toxicologists to appear for pretrial hearings to lay a foundation for the admissibility of nearly every urine test. As you can imagine, our resources are extremely limited. Currently, we have 7 toxicologists working in those 2 laboratories that do essentially all of the urine toxicology for the state of Oregon. Each analyst is obligated to testify in any court proceeding that arises out of their analysis. From the Springfield lab, we travel as far as Klamath County, Lake County, and down to Jackson County, as well as up to this county. And so having to not only attend the trial, but also probably a pretrial hearing in many of these trials would greatly increase our time out of the laboratory. And as you've heard on the prior bill, our focus is trying to keep our analysts in the laboratory analyzing the work so that we can get our backlog reduced and turn out our casework in a timely fashion. Obviously, if our analysts are out of the laboratory, maybe up to double the amount they are now, it would create a fiscal impact on the laboratory. We would have to hire additional scientists to perform the lab work while people were out testifying in court. The Oregon State Police Crime Lab is accredited. We have been since 1985. We're accredited by the American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors Laboratory Accreditation Board. In 2006, we became one of the first crime labs in the country to be accredited under international standards, under ISO 17025 standards. As part of that accreditation, our accrediting body comes in and does surveillance visits each year to make sure that we are following our written procedures, that our written procedures are up to date with the current state of the science. It also looks at our management, our quality assurance programs that are in place. And so that accreditation does provide protection for the people of Oregon that we are doing things in a scientifically acceptable manner. Additionally, the technology that we use, including our EMIT, which is an immunoanalysis screening test, and the GCMS confirmation test that we do on all of our urine samples, those technologies have been around for more than 25 years and are widely used not only in forensics but in all other areas of chemistry and toxicology laboratories. Therefore, there's no real scientific reason for treating urine analysis for drugs and controlled substances any differently than blood alcohol analysis is in the statutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Wampler.
Mr. Wampler?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Randy Wampler, Forensic Services Division Director of the State Police. I'm just here actually to assist with any extra questions regarding operational issues for the Forensics Division.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, first of all? I'm sorry, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose a fairly technical question, perhaps from Ms. Ryerson. On page 2, this is of dash 1, line 9, it talks about how the urine in any civil or criminal action, quote, is admissible. And I'm wondering, as opposed to saying is presumed admissible, I'm just wondering if that overrides, say, a judge's discretion under 403 or anything of that sort.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I believe what this is just doing is saying that we don't have to lay a scientific foundational analysis to say that the urine testing done by the Oregon State Police, it basically admits it into evidence as scientific foundation. But there's still, right, I believe, other challenges that the defense can raise. But as far as the judge can't then say it's not relevant testimony.
I understand. Refollow it, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
I understand that that's the intent of this bill. My only and by the way, I completely agree with the intent of this bill. I just want to make sure that there isn't an unintended consequences of removing a judge's evidentiary discretion under, say, 403 with this specific language. Is it your opinion that it does not do that?
And Chair Barton, Representative Barton, I don't believe it would.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And Gail Meyer, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do oppose House Bill 3051-1 amendments. We recognize that this would bring it into alignment with the procedures currently used with respect to blood tests in DUI cases, but we do feel that it's important for the government to have to lay a scientific foundation before you admit scientific evidence. When you look at this, it basically says a valid chemical analysis is admissible as evidence, and then it defines a valid test if it's performed in an accredited or licensed toxicology laboratory. So it doesn't talk about the validity being in relation to the test. It simply talks about the accreditations of the laboratory. And we think that's the wrong emphasis. The emphasis ought to be on the test itself. Who analyzed it? What did they do? What were the protocols? And were they followed in that given case? So we think it lays a presumption of competency and scientific accuracy that's not warranted, and we would urge a no vote.
Questions for Representative Garrett.
Gail, for blood and breath, does it do the same thing? Do we say it's valid if it's performed in the right place with that reference to methodology? So this would be conforming with that as well.
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that our crime lab has a very solid, strong reputation for precision. That hasn't been the case in a lot of the crime labs around the country, particularly privatized ones. And in Texas, I know they've had some big problems. Do we have any sense of how difficult it is to get this accreditation? Are states that have had the problems also getting accreditation? And maybe this is something that DOJ could get back to us on.
Chair Barker and Representative Shields, your comments are warranted, and I think I am the wrong witness to answer them.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, Randy Walper again, Forensic Services Division. Actually, as a, I am actually an approved assessor for ASCOD Lab accreditation, and have been through these accreditations both on the receiving end and the giving end several times. These standards, especially these international standards, are rigorous standards that are not just pushed through without any consequences. There is the accreditation board, ASCOD Lab, is also a signatory on the International Laboratory Accreditation Cooperation, which is an international group of accrediting bodies who then look at the accreditation boards to make sure that they're doing things right. So there are several layers here of organizations that look at licensed or accrediting laboratories. Our laboratory has gone through all of these rigorous standards and met their standards for accreditation. So I don't know if that helps answer some of your question, but
it does. I have no doubt about the quality of our crime lab. My question was, do you have any sense of what the states that have had problems? I know there's at least two or three high-profile states that have had huge problems where people were inappropriately convicted. Did those states have accreditation? Do you have any sense of that?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I can give you some examples of issues where there has been some problems, and I think probably the largest one is the Houston Police Crime Lab. At the time, they were not accredited, from my understanding. They have come through, and ASCOD Lab was asked to come in and basically do a wholesale analysis of their programs, and they were given time to prepare, and my understanding is that they had quite a difficulty meeting those standards. I believe over the course of several years they finally did meet the accreditation requirements, but it took literally probably 4 or 5 years, and it included management changes, it included protocol changes, literally top down for them to meet those standards.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'd just like to say it's been my experience in dealing with the Oregon State Police Crime Lab for many years. It's not only those things, but it's your personnel that you have in there are just really top quality, and the selection process you go through to get there and to hire people once you're there seems to really be a good one. You have very honest, hardworking, dedicated people, and the state of Oregon is very fortunate to have that caliber of crime lab.
Chair Barker, I appreciate those comments. I totally agree. We have absolutely outstanding people in our crime lab.
They do such good work on TV.
Yeah.
They hate that.
Do you have something? Nope. Anybody, any further questions?
I'm ready.
Okay. Thank you. Close the public hearing. Open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move dash one in House Bill 3051.
Representative Olson moves the dash ones in House Bill 3051. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I move then House Bill 3051 to the floor with due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 3051 as amended to the floor to due pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Fitz.
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, would you carry that bill for us, please? Well, thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 30. A work session, I'm sorry, on House Bill 3091.
3191.
That's what I meant.
3191. Not another one
that I'm missing. House Bill 3191 was first heard on April 6th. Then again, I believe on April 13th or 14th, we adopted the dash twos on the 13th. This one establishes a retired senior volunteer program with the Department of State Police. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means because it has a fiscal statement that estimates that it would be approximately a $60,000, I think, cost per year in order to run this program. So we can proceed on the vote to Ways and Means.
Okay. I don't know if anybody was here to testify about that.
We had Representative Thatcher was here, I believe, at least once, maybe okay. Twice.
No amendments to it.
This is the dash two amendments have been adopted.
Okay. There is established RSVP senior program with exactly the same thing. Do you know if that name is trademarked?
I don't.
We can move this, yeah. Though, and they can work it out later. I just kind of wondered.
Okay. It's ready to go to Ways and Means.
Yeah.
It's
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westnant.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3191 with a dash 2 be referred to the Ways and Means, sent to the Ways and Means.
Representative Westnant moves House Bill 3191 with the dash twos to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Dramatic.
Okay, close the work session 3191. Opening work session on House Bill 2738.
House Bill 2738, first heard March 16th. Then again, yesterday, we adopted the dash two amendments. We now have the paperwork. A minimal expenditure impact non statement was issued.
Can you repeat the number? Which one we're doing?
2738.
As amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2738 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Stigler moves House Bill 2738 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Discussion?
Discussion.
This is a terrible question, but is this a good bill? This bill made me nervous on the, and maybe that just means I'll vote no, and then, was everybody else confident that this was a smart deal? And I know we're moving through a lot of bills. We're an hour, two and a half. But I remember thinking, oh, I don't know about this one, and wanted to have somebody smarter than me, or at least some discussion on the matter.
as I recall, that what the testimony was, that this was would provide a way for a tour to be able to dispose of the car without having to take up the sheriff's time and a lot of extra steps in it.
Was there any opposition?
There was none.
Mr. Chair? County and Washington County in support of it.
Are in support of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't understand where Representative Smith is coming from. I took some look into this bill when it was first heard, not yesterday, and I think the underlying problem, I believe it's ORS 708, and I'm going from memory, involving the tow trucks. It is the most confusing, complicated, and poorly written statute I have encountered in the Oregon Revised Statutes, and so it is unsurprising to me at all that two different counties are interpreting it to mean two different things, and that is a problem this bill is designed to address, because different counties are doing different things. I think this bill, I don't see how this bill can make the statute any less clear. I don't think it has, I have a problem with the bill. That said, I think that we might want to try and rewrite the entire thing, just so it, literally not even substantive change, but just it could use some new language. It's a very rough statute.
And if it helps, Representative Smith, I believe the bill also, what it really does is there's kind of a convoluted process in place. They have been streamlined over time through common practice, and this basically is bringing it in line with what the practice is.
And the sheriff, and I apologize, I'm not keeping, we're being a little bit informal, but what's, and the sheriff's like this?
Yes.
Sheriff's Association supported.
I mean, I've got some experience with this thing, and I agree with what Representative Barton says. If you take a look at the towing statutes, I mean, you have to read through them several different times to really grab a handle on them. You really do. But the bottom line is if you tow a vehicle out there, whether it be a hazard or an abandoned vehicle, the practice had been where the sheriff's office was responsible then for eventually getting rid of it. This all this does is clarify it. And it allows the agency that tows it then to be able to move forward with it for, you know, getting rid of it. So I like the idea.
So a private company tows. So how it actually will happen if this passes, and maybe that's exactly what happens already. Private company tows, and then private company gets permission from so-and-so after a certain amount of time to then sell, yeah.
I believe what it did is that under current statute, if a state police, specifically I think the way I was looking was from the state police, the state police tow a vehicle, you know, a tow truck does it, but they tow it, and then the state police had to turn it over to a local sheriff to then subsequently get rid of the vehicle. State police have started taking care of that themselves. They don't need to go through the local sheriffs in each individual jurisdiction to take care of it. So it's not really about the private enterprise so much as it is about what the public agency is able to do that per statute.
Very helpful. Thanks for the,
Without wanting to hit the slippery slope of on the other side of the building statement, but
we'll fully rewrite the bill.
I'll warn Senator Prozanski about some of the issues that came up.
Mr. Chair, I'll move 2738 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
Okay. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2738 to the floor, as amended to the floor to do pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Enthusiastic, yes.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisner?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
In and out.
Motion carries. You want to explain that one or just put that on consent?
I'm going to carry it.
I'm not it.
I don't care.
Okay, Representative Olson, with the experience, will carry the bill.
That's what he said. He had experience.
Okay. Open a work session House bill. Open.
Again?
3341 announced we're carrying that over till April 23rd, close the work session. On 3341, open a work session House Bill 2477, carry it over to April 23rd, close the work session.
2665, yeah.
That's Bill.
Bill, yeah.
Mr. Taylor.
Okay. We'll jump over.
It's Shannon out, okay.
We're going to go back up the schedule to, as soon as we get our council here. Mr. Taylor, open the work session, House Bill 2665,
Dash 1. Here, members of the committee, House Bill 2665 comes to you from Representative Olson and Senator Brzezinski, and the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission approves the regulations adopted by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. You have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, which delete two references to regulations because the Criminal Justice Commission decided that it was better that these be handled in statute, not by regulation. These regulations are unique in the sense that they are required to be approved by the legislature. You have a respectable fiscal on the bill, and you also, I just got a letter signed by you and by the Speaker of the House referring the bill to Ways and Means Committee. I've had a discussion with Craig Prince about that, and he understands the need to do so. In the 2009-2011 biennium, it has a fiscal of $83,000. In the 2011-2013 biennium, has a fiscal of $268,749.
Okay. So, first item on it is the adopting the Dash 1.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1s into House Bill 2665.
Representative Wisnett moves the Dash 1s into House Bill 2665. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move House Bill 2665 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee for a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2665 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Woodman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Do you have any more comment? Musical chairs. And we can move this one over.
Did you move this already?
Yeah.
Okay.
So can you please say both of these, just announce on the record you're carrying both of these for 423.
Okay, I did the other one. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2477 and move it to April 23rd and close the work session.
And we did that for 3341,
yeah, we
correct?
Did
we did it for 2477, too, yeah. And 3341. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Same
yes.
Same about.
No, we can.
Okay, carry over.
So we're in here.
Carry that one.
Open a work session on House Bill 2790 and carry that over till April 22nd. Close the work session. Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2502.
Okay. House Bill 2502 was first heard on April 15th. The Dash 2 amendments have been adopted. The Dash 2 amendments delete the original bill and authorize the seizure or production of documents in accordance with a subpoena or warrant from a recipient outside Oregon, regardless of location where the recipient receives service or where the records are physically located. We have received the paperwork back on the Dash 2 amendments, and there's a minimal expenditure impact non-statement that's been issued. I'm also aware that there are, as of this morning, 2502-3, so there are Dash 3 amendments, which we do not have any paperwork on.
So Dash 2s have a minimal fiscal?
Yes.
So we can move the Dash 2s.
We can move it. And Representative Olson, I believe, this is his bill.
Representative Olson, you want to introduce the Dash 2s?
We'll move the Dash 2s then into House Bill 2502.
It's been adopted.
No, it's not yet adopted.
Yes,
no.
They have been.
They have?
They have been, yeah, okay.
To the Dash 2s.
What do the Dash 3s do? Do you know?
Pardon?
Do you know what the Dash
3s? Dash 3s are from Representative Barton.
Representative Barton. Chair. If I may, so the Dash 2s and Dash 3s, Dash 3s is essentially just a slight and fairly technical revision of the Dash 2 amendments, I believe. I have no trouble moving the Dash 2s today, provided that there is an understanding that the dash threes will largely be adopted on the other side. I believe there's one change we want to make on the dash threes because of a lack of clarity. In the interest of time, I'm prepared to do it. I think there's some consensus on what is largely the dash three amendments. Yes? That's all I need. There's one provision on the first page, I believe, section two of the dash threes, section one, subsection two, that I think we're still going to take a look at on the other side. Other than that, I think there's a consensus on dash threes.
There's no way I can promise you what happens when it moves that other to the other side, but we'll do what we can on that. It's okay. Yes. Discussion.
Okay with you, Representative?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Amended. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
We adopted dash two.
Dash twos are in.
Chair, I move House Bill
2502 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2502 as amended to the floor to do pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. And Representative Olson, carry that one, please. You've been doing a lot of work on that. And open a work session on House Bill 2306.
House Bill 2306, first heard in January, then again on April 15th. We adopted the dash threes on the 15th. We have the paperwork back. There's no expenditure impact.
Okay. What were the dash threes again?
The dash threes changed the homestead exemption, I believe, from 40 to an area of $40,000 to $50,000.
Go ahead, Mr. Mark, can you just sign that one?
So the dash twos are in? Dash threes are in?
Yes.
Okay, I'd like to discuss it when we get to them. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2306 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2306 as amended to the floor to do pass and discussion.
So this is a compromise now? They came up with an agreement on this?
It is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Shields?
I think there was some debate over what the word compromise meant last time. Is this a compromise meaning
accurate.
That the Bar Association is okay with this?
Well, David's right here.
The Bar actually had the dash two amendments.
Right.
Dash three.
2306. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Niebel with the Oregon State Bar. We are supportive of the dash three amendments. We would preferred dash four, but we'll be happy with any progress on this bill, and we would support the dash three amendments.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Hope.
Call roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Okay. Representative Krieger will carry the bill. Is there any other business carried for the committee today? Meeting adjourned.